Olá, eu sou a Vera Magalhães. Você está ouvindo o Roda Viva em versão podcast. Todas as terças-feiras, confira o programa na íntegra nos principais tocadores de áudio. Olá, boa noite. Roda Viva está no ar para todo o Brasil pela TV Cultura e emissoras afiliadas e nas telas do mundo todo por meio das nossas plataformas digitais. Não é todo dia que recebemos neste programa um vencedor do Prêmio Nobel da Paz. Também não é usual que esse ganhador seja uma mulher e uma jornalista. A nossa entrevistada recebeu essa laurea em 2021 por enfrentar, do alto de seu 1,60m de altura, uma perseguição implacável do regime do autocrata Rodrigo Duterte nas Filipinas, o seu país natal. Ela enfrentou isso contra si e também contra o Rappler, a plataforma de jornalismo independente que ela fundou e dirige juntamente com outras sócias chamadas de Manangs. Ler o seu livro Como Enfrentar um Ditador, um misto de autobiografia e libelo pela defesa da liberdade de imprensa, aciona vários gatilhos para jornalistas que, assim como ela, são acossados por regimes que tentam solapar a democracia e a liberdade de imprensa. Mas ela resiste. Neste ano, obteve uma vitória num de muitos processos sem nenhuma fundamentação jurídica a que ela responde como uma forma de tentar silenciá-la. Para que o Brasil também conheça a trajetória virtuosa dessa defensora das liberdades, que nas horas vagas também é fã de Star Trek, toca 8 instrumentos e até anda de skate pela redação, o Roda Viva tem a honra de receber remotamente, direto da Colômbia, a jornalista e escritora filipina Maria Ressa.
Maria Angelita Ressa tem 59 anos e nasceu numa família humilde de Manila. Aos 10 anos e órfã de pai, se mudou com a mãe para os Estados Unidos durante a ditadura de Ferdinand Marcos nas Filipinas. Formou-se em biologia molecular com louvor pela Universidade de Princeton. Resolveu voltar às Filipinas depois das manifestações populares que derrubaram Marcos. Fez mestrado em jornalismo na Universidade das Filipinas e foi uma das criadoras do maior portal de notícias do país, o Rappler. Se tornou a principal opositora à gestão autoritária do então presidente filipino Rodrigo Duterte, que deixou o cargo ano passado. Ressa e outros jornalistas denunciaram uma série de crimes e abusos realizados sob seu comando, sobretudo o assassinato de cidadãos suspeitos de tráfico de drogas e a disseminação de desinformação para manipular a população. Foi perseguida, presa e ameaçada de morte em rede nacional. Em 2021, foi uma das ganhadoras do Prêmio Nobel da Paz, junto com o jornalista russo Dmitry Muratov, por seus esforços para salvaguardar a liberdade de expressão. Ela também lançou o livro Como Enfrentar um Ditador, no qual fala da importância de combater governos autoritários, compartilhando com o leitor métodos de como fazer isso. No livro, Maria Ressa se baseia não apenas no regime de Rodrigo Duterte, mas também as administrações de Jair Bolsonaro, Donald Trump e outros.
Para entrevistar a ganhadora do Nobel da Paz, Maria Ressa, nós convidamos para a nossa bancada Cecília Oliveira, jornalista do The Intercept Brasil, Adriana Ferreira Silva, jornalista e escritora, Patrícia Campos Melo, repórter especial da Folha de São Paulo e autora do prefácio da edição brasileira de Como Enfrentar um Ditador, Jefferson Barbosa, editor do Perifa Connection, e Kátia Brembate, presidente da Abrage e editora do Estadão Verifica. Boa noite, Maria. Muito obrigada por ter aceitado o nosso convite. Muita honra receber você.
Thank you for having me. How wonderful to speak to you. And no one knows these problems better than Brazil.
Verdade. Eu queria começar te ouvindo, Maria, a respeito de que maneira, no seu entender, a concessão do Nobel da Paz foi um ativo, ajudou você a defender a liberdade de imprensa, não só nas Filipinas, como no mundo todo, voltou as atenções do mundo para esse problema que é global e também ajudou a reagir e a resistir ao assédio judicial que você sofre no seu país.
I think the Nobel Prize was a lift for journalists all around the world because For over a decade now, journalists have come under increasing attacks, either more journalists killed, more journalists jailed. The weaponization of the law has been used against a lot more. And I think in 2021, it was the first time since 1935 that the Norwegian Nobel Committee recognized that the work journalists do are critical to democracies all around the world, and that we have, many of you have felt this in Brazil, that we have had to sacrifice a lot more just to keep doing our jobs. For us in Rappler, of course, it was a vindication. That was how my team felt. And for me, frankly, I was shocked and still am, you know, that Edward Munch painting, The Scream, I'm still doing that. But I think for all of us, it gives us more energy, hope, and courage to keep holding power to account, to keep trying to tell our public how they're being manipulated by the technology that holds us together.
É verdade, com certeza. Patrícia.
Bom, primeiro, parabéns. Boa noite, Maria. Parabéns pela sua vitória judicial recente. Imagino que deva ser um alívio. Existe uma discussão hoje em dia sobre a extrema-direita se diz censurada nas redes sociais. As tentativas de moderação estão sendo vendidas como isso é uma censura e deveria ter uma liberdade de expressão maior nas redes sociais. Você acha que dá para conciliar você não ter um discurso de ódio ou a tornar, transformar em armas as redes sociais, ao mesmo tempo que você mantém a liberdade de expressão?
Oh my gosh, Patricia, you know better than anyone, you know, how social media has weaponized speech, right? This is not a free speech issue. This is freedom of speech being used to stifle not just the work of journalists, but other people whose messages are not aligned with the far right. So let me make that clear, right? I think what we have seen, and this is from all of the data, and let's talk about Brazil, right? Jair Bolsonaro was a fringe extreme up until YouTube algorithms brought him, combined him with conspiracy theory. So the far right and conspiracy theories became its own group. This is research done by people in Harvard University that basically showed that his support, that the far right was created by algorithmic clustering recommendations that people were radicalized. And this first happened on YouTube and then amplified on the other social media platforms. In the Philippines, it would be Facebook, similar things, right? So you can see Brazil as an example of how far-right fringe or kind of off the scale on the fringe conspiracy theories are pulled together by recommendation algorithms that are meant to keep you scrolling. If you watch one video, it keeps bringing you down into the rabbit hole, literally radicalizing you, right? So not only are these algorithms polarizing, they also, as recommendation of content, radicalize. Okay, so if you think about it like that, this is not a freedom of speech issue at all. And actually, what you can see is that the design of social media platforms have actually empowered the far right, far more distorted the public sphere, right? It united disparate groups that would never have found each other in the real world and gave them unparalleled power to take over the public information ecosystem, not just in Brazil, but in all other parts of the world. And then it moves out of one country and actually acts as a nervous system that is global in scope.
Cecília.
Maria, uma honra poder estar aqui com você e, infelizmente, discutindo esse assunto que afeta toda a nossa categoria. E, complementando, inclusive, a pergunta da Patrícia, você já começou a falar sobre a importância das grandes plataformas no modo de fazer jornalístico, inclusive porque eles podem ampliar o acesso ou, no caso, se virar contra nós, como é o caso de, como você disse em uma das suas conferências. O Duterte usou muito dessa plataforma para iniciar perseguição a você. E a gente viu isso aqui também no Brasil. Como que você enxerga a relação das big techs com a democracia? E eu gostaria de saber se nós precisamos de legislação específica que imponha limites, regulações, que entenda como é que vocês podem funcionar no nosso país respeitando a nossa democracia.
Big tech is destroying and has destroyed democracy all around the world, right? And there's a fundamental issue. It is systematic in approach in the design of these social media platforms that are meant to keep you scrolling on your cell phone, right? And what is that? The fundamental problem is that, and this is an MIT study from 2018, lies by design spread faster and further than facts. And more than that, if you lace it with anger and hate, with us against them, then you get amplification that you would never have been able to do. Journalists, news organizations, don't do this. We can't lie. If you lie, you are legally liable, right? And yet, that is the incentive structure of the social media platforms. So think about it like this. It's almost like if you have kids, you tell your kids, lie, I'll reward you. And then you go further, lie all the time, and I will reward you. It's not a coincidence that illiberal leaders like Jair Bolsonaro, like Rodrigo Duterte, like Viktor Orban, that these illiberal leaders rise up, do well on social media, that there is both their own information operations where they deploy to pound narratives of silence, but also kind of to build their own reach, which these platforms give them free rein. Right? Lie all the time, right? They get elected democratically, and then they crush institutions from within. In the meantime, what do journalists do? We keep doing our stories, but it isn't enough because the algorithmic amplification deprioritizes stories that are factual based, right? If you're not inciting to anger or hate, if you're not lying, it just doesn't get the widest distribution. So this is part of the reason you have, and I'm going to put them in quotes, influencers who have risen and had tremendous reach, and news organizations until today, from 2018 until today, you will see that our amplification on social media has actually decreased. So what does that mean for the future of journalism? If you only live on this distribution platform, and Brazil used to have, you had your own social media platforms, I mean, wide reach of social media, this means that the worst journalism is amplified, gets the widest reach. And if you're an investigative journalist, you don't get that reach. So this is in addition to segmenting the audiences, but then simultaneously, even if you are doing good journalism, you're not going to get the reach. And bad journalism is the one that gets the widest reach. Sim. It's a horrific perfect storm.
Jefferson, por favor.
Maria, boa noite. É um prazer estar conversando com você. E parabéns pelo Nobel. Eu vou seguir um pouco na pergunta das colegas, falando das big techs. No livro você trata muito disso e como que o algoritmo, né, e os algoritmos dessas plataformas contribuem para a profusão de fake news e como que isso, não só no caso das Filipinas e do Brasil, mas também dos Estados Unidos, por exemplo, contribuíram para o crescimento e até para a eleição de uma extrema-direita. Ao mesmo tempo, a gente vê no seu livro um pouco do debate dos desafios de se sustentar um meio de comunicação independente. E a gente vê essas mesmas big techs financiando, né, propondo financiamento para essa mídia, né, independente, com o argumento de que está fortalecendo a imprensa e a democracia. Como é que você vê isso no que diz respeito à qualidade dessa democracia e à autonomia né, dos repórteres, que são financiados por essas mesmas big techs que alimentam esses algoritmos?
Thank you for the question. Let me go over the two instances that we as in humanity are being manipulated. And then I'll talk about the impact on journalism. So the first thing is that these social media platforms, regardless, they're pretty much the same. And TikTok is the worst, right? It takes advantage of our emotions, our biology, manipulating us because our emotions are manipulated to change our worldview, to change the way we think. The platforms, these big tech companies, are designed for addiction, little bursts of dopamine, right? And these are in Facebook's own internal documents that were released, more than 10,000 of them released by Francis Haugen, the Facebook whistleblower. What that means is that the crisis we face is our own biology, the ability for our emotions to shift the way we think, and the way technology is doing this without our knowledge. So that's the first step. They're literally treating people all around the world like Pavlov's dogs. And what happens is when you say a lie a million times, it becomes a fact. You cannot tell the difference between fact and fiction. And a leader, a figure that lies, that's bombastic, that gives people in our countries freedom to be their worst selves, those tend to get the widest amplification, right? Lula won by just 1% there. You barely made it because our biology is used against us. So this algorithmic manipulation is micro-targeting, but it's also, as I pointed out earlier, the recommendation of what content to serve you. And that radicalizes you even more. The impact on our next generation, on kids, increased depression, increased instances of suicide. They live shallow lives and this stops a search for meaning, for learning, right? Okay, so did I paint a horrific picture? This is what we're living in. What is the impact on journalists? This same platforms are used to target us. Patricia went through this. I am sure other women journalists and male journalists have gone through this. In the Philippines, women are targeted at least 10 times more than men. But what they do is, it's part of military doctrine in Russia. They pound a target, whether it's one journalist, they pound you with a lie to literally change the meta-narrative. In my case, the meta-narrative was, you know, I used to be seen as a good journalist in the Philippines. But now, in 2016, the Duterte administration and its supporters came out with journalist equals criminal. Maria is a criminal. They pounded that a million times. People began to believe the lie. And how do you as a journalist react to that? You can't. And then a year later, President Duterte said the same thing in his State of the Nation address. A week after that, we got our first subpoena. So you have the weaponization of social media followed by the weaponization of the law. How do we deal with this as journalists? We keep doing our jobs at tremendous risk to ourselves, to our organizations that are bleeding money. In the case, Patricia actually filed a case back, right, and won it. Let's see what happens in the Philippines. The fear has lifted. There is now, with the verdict, kicking out four tax evasion cases that could have sent me to prison for 34 years. I, again, have hope, right?
Adriana.
Boa noite, Maria. Primeiramente, eu queria dizer que é uma honra estar entre as jornalistas que aí estão entrevistando. É, queria dar um passinho atrás. É, por quê? A Vera disse muito bem que o seu livro, Como Derrubar um Ditador, principalmente para nós jornalistas, ele traz muitos gatilhos, porque nós vivemos todo esse processo, primeiro de encantamento com as redes sociais e depois de ver como as redes sociais transformaram e são usadas, como você diz no livro, como alto-falantes para o discurso de ódio, a desinformação e as teorias conspiratórias. Como eu gostaria que o seu livro fosse lido por muita gente, eu queria que você falasse muito brevemente, porque é uma história longa, quais são os momentos chaves, em retrospectiva, quais são os momentos chaves que levaram as redes sociais a se transformarem, né, nisso, terem esse papel, e como as Filipinas se tornaram um microcosmos de experimentação para o que depois seria feito nos Estados Unidos, na Inglaterra, no Brasil.
So, thank you for the question. I think if you look at technology platforms, big tech, they've been around for 20 years. And in the last 6 years, they've changed their algorithms to the point that it has destroyed our shared space. You know, so let me go back to 2014. 2014 is when the meta narratives were introduced. Russian military warfare essentially used Russian changed the meta narrative around Crimea. And in that one, they seeded this first on social media before coming out and annexing Crimea. So Russia annexed Crimea, starting first with the meta narrative. That same meta narrative was used in 2022 for Russia to go ahead and invade Ukraine itself. In the Philippines in 2014, we had Ferdinand Marcos Jr. begin information operations that literally changed history in front of our eyes. His father, his family, his father was a dictator for 21 years in the Philippines. People power ousted the family, forced them into exile in 1986 for stealing $10 billion in 1986 dollars. And starting in 2014, we saw information operations that changed our history in front of our eyes. Think about Milan Kundera, right? He said that the struggle of man against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting. But here you go, it's being changed in front of our eyes. We're forgetting because information operations is literally treating us like Pavlov's dogs, right? So fast forward, what happened in 2016? It took 2 years before the political dominoes began to fall in the Philippines in 2016. Rodrigo Duterte won as president. He continued, and this is in the book, Information Operations, and combined it with Marcos. Marcos and Duterte disinformation networks worked together. 2016 is when the political dominoes began to fall. The Philippines in May, less than about a month later, you had Brexit, and then you had all of the elections coming forward, ending in November. It was Donald Trump elected in the United States. Again, very similar. Cambridge Analytica was critical in this. And what's so interesting with Cambridge Analytica is that the United States had the most number of compromised accounts, but the Philippines was number two, mm-hmm. right? Why the Philippines? Because by 2017, 100% of Filipinos on the internet are on Facebook. This is where we saw it was YouTube and Facebook, right? Seeded on YouTube. Now it's YouTube, TikTok, and Facebook. This is how we watched history change. Finally, I would point out in 2018, after Cambridge Analytica, after that became a global story, the platforms changed their algorithms one more time, and they keep doing this to tweak news out of the feed. They never tried to make a distinction between fact and fiction. In fact, the fiction spread faster, right? And by doing that, they have now doomed us in the next level of technology. If the AI is fed lies, cannot tell the difference between lies and facts, how will that AI then order the world? This is a fundamental flaw in the technology we're using.
Kátia?
É uma satisfação estar aqui falando com você, principalmente pelo que você representa para o jornalismo no mundo. No Brasil, a gente está vivendo uma situação aí 10 anos já de uma escalada de violência que só aumenta. A gente achava que quando ia arrefecer, que quando ia diminuir, na verdade, aumentava. E agora, no período pós-segundo turno das eleições, a gente viveu uma situação sem precedentes na história brasileira democrática, com mais de um ataque a jornalista por dia. Quando a gente achou que isso ia diminuir, veio a questão em Brasília, da invasão em Brasília, do que a gente chama aqui de 8 de janeiro, com mais de 40 casos de ataque a jornalistas. Várias organizações do Brasil, 11 organizações, se reuniram, fizeram um relatório que será entregue nos próximos dias ao governo brasileiro, ao recém-criado Observatório de Violência contra Jornalista. Mas a gente sabe que essa realidade que a gente está vivendo aqui no Brasil não é uma exclusividade. A gente sabe que isso está em escala global, em governos de direita e de esquerda no mundo inteiro. A questão é que o jornalismo foi colocado como inimigo, né, como alvo a ser atingido. Como é que a gente reverte esse processo? O que que o jornalismo precisa fazer para reverter esse processo?
Katia, thank you for the question, but unfortunately, it's the algorithms that are doing it. It is technology that is doing it, and we are the victims. The data has shown us that online violence is real world violence, and yet these algorithms of distribution prioritize the spread, not just of lies, but anger and hate. I called it in the Nobel lecture, toxic sludge. It incites hate, it incites violence, and that's part of the reason that violence has increased, right? There is a real world social harm, far more also. Journalists, we are at the front lines in this because we keep trying to do our jobs. And yet the people who used to be our audience are being inflamed by the toxic sludge of the social media platforms. So, you know, I discuss this all the time with other heads of news organization, and they keep asking, what can we do to regain trust? Unfortunately, it is not in our hands. We gave up the rights of distribution, except maybe right now you control of the television, of the satellite waves that are pushing this. But online, it is algorithmic amplification, right? It is Google that will bring search back to your website. It is social media that will distribute this. And when they do that, they will not prioritize rational behavior, rational thought. They will prioritize far more incendiary. So here's the problem. How do we stop it? Laws. We must demand citizens, what social media platforms call users. We need to demand accountability from these social media platforms. And then that must be turned into legislation. Look, in the book, I talk about how we deal with this problem right now of insidious manipulation of our emotions, right? And I'd say education is the long term. In the medium term, it's got to be legislation. Because if your journalists are getting this many attacks in a day, this is a systemic social problem. And it is triggered by our patterns of communication, by the design of the platforms that spread it. In the short term, we must organize because journalists can't do this alone. We need to do this with civil society, with business groups, because you cannot have integrity of facts. If you don't have integrity of facts, you cannot have integrity. I mean, look, Brazil is a perfect example. Look at the number of people, starting with Zika, and then moving on to COVID. There are health issues involved here. Anything that impacts our emotions and our mind will determine how we act in the real world. So going back, online violence is real world violence. There should be gatekeepers in place.
Com isso, então, a gente fecha o primeiro bloco desse maravilhoso programa com a Maria Ressa. Vai para um breve intervalo e volta já já com mais Roda Viva. Estamos de volta com o Roda Viva, que hoje tem a honra de receber a vencedora do Prêmio Nobel da Paz, Maria Ressa. Maria, eu quero continuar com você nesse tema da regulação. O Brasil depois de tudo que aconteceu e de, inclusive, viver uma tentativa de golpe de Estado em 8 de janeiro desse ano, discute várias formas de chegar a essa regulação. A Suprema Corte tem sido muito ativa em suspender conteúdos, retirar conteúdos do ar, mas também tem discussões sendo travadas no campo do Legislativo e do Executivo. No seu entendimento, precisa de todo esse conjunto de medidas, de várias instâncias de poder e também de uma iniciativa global que una os países nessa regulação?
It must be global because these platforms are global. But I think the first thing is, it's not about censorship or removing content. It's about redefining the design of the platforms, right? If you don't stop the lies, if you make lies, and facts equal, then you literally shake the entire world, because you don't want to tell people to keep lying, right? That's the first. The second is online violence. When you allow this at the level that it is allowed, is real world violence. And the last part is impunity. You will not have accountability if you allow impunity online. So all of these things, I think we need to look at the algorithms, the choices that were made in the design, not the content. When you walk into content, then it becomes a free speech issue, and we're both democracies. Uhum. We have to go back to the design.
Certo, Patrícia.
Você começou a soar o alarme sobre o perigo de desinformação em 2016. Agora, você até diz no livro que você se sente uma mistura de Sísifo com Cassandra, né? Desde então, tentando ali. E a gente tem visto desde o ano passado, de forma mais generalizada, o ChatGPT, que é inteligência artificial muito evoluída, que consegue gerar textos que é muito difícil você diferenciar o que foi feito pela máquina, o que foi feito por um humano. De onde você vê o próximo desafio de desinformação? De onde vem a próxima ameaça? Tem a ver com essa inteligência artificial?
It's more than just the artificial intelligence. It's the exponential use of information. And if there aren't any guardrails in place, then we literally will reshape reality. This is what we're living through. But yes, you know, so we talked about AI just a little bit, right? Artificial intelligence. What is AI? Let me first define. An algorithm is just opinion in code. Imagine, Patricia, if you're replicated a million times, you make a Patricia editorial decision, and then you make a machine do it a million times, right? Algorithm is opinion and code. When it is coded, it has all of the biases of whoever coded it. And we have absolutely no control over this because it was done by Silicon Valley. That's obviously led to January 6th and then January 8th in Brazil. So that's the first. The second one is, AI is programmed by what? All of the information that is out there, both in books, in everything that is out there, including the lies, right? So garbage, if you put garbage in, you will get garbage out. And if you look at the AI right now, it says it can weave a fantasy. It can be wrong. Again, it's that idea that it is okay to be wrong in the public sphere. That's the guardrail that has been pulled out. It's not just text, it is also photos, it is also video. It's easy now to lie, but will there be accountability? I think that's the key part.
Maria, a história está cheia de ditadores. Alguns tomaram o poder pela força e outros foram eleitos, né? Você falou bastante da questão do algoritmo, da manipulação das emoções, da gestão do medo, né? Você fala bastante sobre como esses algoritmos fazem uma gestão do medo, né? Mas como que é possível para o jornalismo, para os ativistas, para a sociedade lidar com um governo que foi eleito, portanto, que tem maioria da população apoiando, né? Como se lida com uma situação construída que chega ao apoio popular?
It's Brazil actually showed us the way here, right? But look at how much your initial surveys actually showed 30%, and it came down to 1%, the gap between Lula and Bolsonaro. And now you're still dealing with this, right? I think It is a cascading failure. It is the reason why the world is moving towards fascism. And I don't use the word lightly, because essentially our information ecosystem, these algorithms that reward lies, are letting us, are pushing us to elect these illiberal leaders in democratic elections. Once they're elected, they crush the institutions from within and they install people like them. We have seen this happen in country after country. Right now, 60% of the world is under autocracies, right? Shifting towards fascism. We are back to 1989 levels of democracy. If we do not do something to put guardrails in place around the technology and the manipulation of people, the use of anger and hate of us against them, that is Nazi Germany, right? This goes to these huge, massive excesses that turned the world upside down. If we don't do this, by 2024, there will be more illiberal leaders elected who are then allying with each other, democratic globally. Right. So I guess I will throw the question back to you. Brazil had to do a lot in order to elect, to not elect Bolsonaro, to elect Lula. And you still are dealing with the repercussions of this. I think in the Philippines, we look to you. Right. What we can see the data in our own. In our case, it's the shift of history. If you forget your history, how will you know whom to elect? If you don't have integrity of facts, how will you have integrity of elections? This is the problem, the fundamental problem we face today.
A Cecília pediu a palavra, mas eu vou só aproveitar a pergunta da Kátia para te replicar uma outra coisa ainda a esse respeito. Além dessa questão toda de lidar com os algoritmos e o que eles causam em termos de radicalização da população, tem uma tarefa que é da política, uma tarefa que é dos partidos e das instituições, que é de banir do processo eleitoral e democrático esses líderes que estressam a democracia a partir de dentro. O Partido Republicano não fez isso, os Estados Unidos ainda não fizeram isso. Você acha que essa é uma tarefa importante também, Maria?
Let me say something that I repeated over and over in the book. Silence is consent. I think we were all surprised in 2016 when leaders began attacking in ways that they never did before. We had elected these kinds of digital authoritarians, illiberal leaders, and the way they managed was actually using the information ecosystem to stifle free speech. This is part of what was done to us. We just kept going, right? There were information. I was getting an average of 90 hate messages per hour. But more than that, politicians must call each other out. A perfect example in the United States, you have a congressman who lied repeatedly. And some of his party members knew that. And yet, he is now a lawmaker. Mm-hmm. I'm talking of George Santos, right? If this is happening in the United States, it is happening everywhere else. How do we stop impunity? How do we get accountability? I push for the nature, the goodness of human nature, the accountability of public service to actually push to stop the silence on gross impunity.
Sim, Cecília. É um pouco difícil da gente ter esperança de enxergar essas mudanças daqui a pouco. E pensando que as gigantes de tecnologia agem, inclusive cercando as possíveis demandas de mudança, como é que a gente faria nesse sentido? Porque você citou o Google, por exemplo. Então, o Google tentou na Austrália, falou, olha, eu vou sair daqui se vocês tentarem regular. O Facebook cortou os pagamentos que faziam a jornais para ter acesso ao material deles. Mas, como o Jefferson mencionou, essas mesmas Big Techs, elas investem, né, com alguns grants em jornais E como que a gente pode analisar essa situação pensando que o modo como a gente enxergava o jornalismo do tipo, olha, temos uma grande história, um grande furo, por exemplo, como a Cambridge Analytica, e isso vai mobilizar a opinião pública para demandar mudanças. Só que ela controla essa demanda por mudanças. É possível a gente ter alguma esperança de enxergar mudanças na legislação, como você disse, e na demanda da mobilização pública por dizer agora chega, a gente prefere a democracia e a gente prefere as coisas antes dessa manipulação em massa.
Yeah, a little bit of hope, right? Where, how do we fight distribution of lies? How do we keep doing journalism? I look forward in Q2. The Digital Services Act and the Digital Markets Act will be rolled out in the EU. It isn't a perfect law, but it is one of the first to address algorithmic amplification, the distribution, right? And it is attempting to hold big tech accountable. I think globally, I've been certainly talking about this like Sisyphus and Cassandra, because the data is very clear. This is like big tobacco. It is very harmful, not just to us as individuals, but to society as a whole. It is harmful to the next generation. So I think that the first is we need to hold big tech to account the way we used to be able to hold journalists accountable. Right? And what's the first thing they can do? Well, the United States, for example, where big tech spends $70 million annually to lobby lawmakers, the United States must get rid. I said this in the Nobel lecture. It must reform or revoke Section 230. If you make these platforms accountable for what they distribute, I believe lies will go down.
Jefferson.
Maria, você acabou de citar o Nobel, e é um prêmio que reconhece muito lideranças, defensores, né? Defensores de direitos e tal. E eu, como também jornalista e também ativista, volta e meia vejo pessoas questionando um pouco desse lugar, de como se fosse possível você ser um jornalista, um repórter, e isso necessariamente deve estar separado do lugar de ativista, por exemplo, de direitos humanos ou de outros movimentos. Mas, ao mesmo tempo, a nossa função não é uma tarefa burocrática, né? Com tais histórias que a gente conta, mesmo quando se trata da democracia ou da situação política de um país, a gente não está simplesmente narrando, né? A gente é afetado por isso. Então, eu queria te perguntar, para novos jornalistas, para as novas gerações que estão se formando, acompanhando já essas transformações todas que estão sendo mencionadas aqui, de financiamento, da questão da internet, é possível... É possível ser jornalista e não ser ativista, não ser defensor dos direitos humanos, por exemplo?
Jefferson, I'm an old journalist. You know, I mean, I grew up in the golden age of journalism, and I would never have called myself an activist when facts were not debatable. I was trained not to be a participant, not to be an activist. When I took over as the head of the largest news organization in the Philippines, I was in charge of the standards and ethics manuals, right? And we always stood for freedom of speech. We would talk about that. We would talk about accountability, but we held ourselves accountable. The problem now is that facts are debatable. When facts are under attack, when journalists are under attack, then it becomes activism. I am a reluctant activist, and I've learned to be, because facts are not debatable. I mean, you can do this on social media, but in the end, that will change the real world. It changes the way people act. You have January 6th in the US, you have January 8th in Brazil, right? So this violates law. In every sense, is that activism to call out that these algorithms by design are inflaming us into violence? I don't think that's activism. I think that's a fact. So I think we have to define, this is such a unique time. It is a time of creative destruction. The world as we knew it is gone. The world where television was king, I miss those days, because we would hold power to account, but we would also be responsible to our public in a way that, frankly, big tech is not. It has been profit at all costs. So September 4th last year, Dmitry Muratov, who won the Nobel Peace Prize with me in 2021, we came out with a 10-point action plan supported by a dozen or so other Nobel laureates and about 100 groups. 10 points, constitutional level. The first, we must stop surveillance for profit. Second, stop coded bias. And finally, the third one is journalism as an antidote to tyranny. Which, look, journalists challenge power to our detriment. Patricia can talk about, you know, what is it like to be targeted? You know you're targeted. It's a time to make these definitions. The definitions must shift, and we need to create the world that holds power accountable.
Adriana?
Maria, nos últimos 20 anos, eu trabalhei principalmente criando conteúdo e estratégias digitais em três dos maiores grupos de comunicação do Brasil. Principalmente nos últimos anos, eu me sentia um pouco dividida. Eu trabalhava para a empresa de comunicação e para as big techs, porque eu tinha que entender todas as estratégias para ganhar audiência no Google, estratégias de SEO, boas práticas de redes sociais como o Facebook ou o Instagram. E eu sinto que isso tem, de alguma maneira, precarizado o jornalismo, porque nós vivemos uma crise em que as equipes são muito pequenas, e com essas equipes muito pequenas, a gente tem que, de um lado, fazer um jornalismo sério, e de outro, a gente tem que bater metas de audiência que são, em geral, altíssimas, conquistar seguidores em redes sociais, enfim, seguir as boas práticas das redes sociais. Fazendo aquilo que você fala no seu livro, que é o caça-clique, a isca de clique. Então, hoje em dia, você entra nos portais sérios do Brasil e aí você vê notícias sérias junto com memes e, enfim, notícias apelativas. Enquanto a gente tem responsabilidade nisso, e quão prejudicial é essa lógica do page view, da busca pelos enormes page views?
Extremely harmful. Dangerously so. It commodified news, right? Again, I talk about the incentive structure. It turned the world upside down because the incentive is to lie. The incentive is bad journalism. The incentive is manipulation of anger and hate. Journalists don't do this. Okay, let me pull back and just point out, you're right. I think ultimately technology and journalism will come together because we need to put distribution and content back to protect the public sphere. We need to have a shared reality. But right now, we're depending on these tech platforms who have put profit at all costs, a business model that essentially clones every user and then micro-targets. Artificial intelligence takes all of our clones, those individual posts, builds a model of you, clones you, and then pulls it up to this database that is used to micro-target, to insidiously manipulate you. That is the new advertising. So yes, part of our problem is that bad journalism is what is getting the widest distribution. So how do we fix this? In the immediate short term, we build communities of action. We come back to the real world. We must. And then we demand better of these tech platforms. You're seeing this. I was just in Albany last week. Sorry, New Albany Foundation in Ohio, where it was snowing. And, you know, I asked, there were about 600 students, high school students. I asked them, which platforms are they on? TikTok. So these are American public school students. TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, less than 20 people raised their hands. So all these platforms are now it is an attention economy. Journalism as it stands today, we cannot compete in this world. So, and yet, society needs facts. Society needs a shared reality. That's the dichotomy. But I am with you in, you know, when you commodify news, when you make it about page views, then you don't do good journalism. This is part of the reason in Rappler, we don't show our reporters page views on purpose. because I do not want them. This is not a popularity rating. Facts are not debatable. Good stories holding power to account are necessary.
Certo. Com isso, então, a gente fecha o nosso segundo bloco, vai para mais uma rápida interrupção e volta já já com mais Maria Ressa. Eu disse que era rápido, Roda Viva está de volta e quem vai perguntar para Maria Ressa agora é a Kátia Brembate.
Maria, eu queria falar de um assunto que é tabu, que é saúde mental de jornalista. Né? Por muito tempo a gente não falou desse assunto como se não existisse um ser humano por trás daquele profissional. Tem um levantamento dos mais de 1 milhão de ataques que você recebeu, que mostra, você dá uma declaração dizendo que 60% mostrava que tentava te atingir na credibilidade e 40% no espírito. Né? Esse cenário que você vive, num grau muito mais exacerbado, também faz parte da realidade de jornalistas no mundo inteiro. Você chegou a contar que você ofereceu terapia para toda a sua equipe e você percebeu que você precisava treinar os psicólogos que não sabiam lidar com aquela demanda, né? Eu queria entender como esse adoecimento dos profissionais, das profissionais, está atingindo o jornalismo, porque estamos adoecendo. E queria perguntar para você, né, como isso te atinge, né? Você sempre diz que você não está sozinha, que seus valores te fortalecem, né, que a companhia te fortalece, mas como essa questão da saúde mental também te afeta?
I think the first is to realize that you will come under attack if you do good journalism. I mean, we always used to have a different version of this before. Now it's just much more personal. And it targets, I was speaking last night with Carol Cadwalader, the British journalist who broke the Cambridge Analytica story. And she said that, you know, she had talked about this, like they took what they felt were her most vulnerable points and they attacked it. And so you need to steel yourself, right? And the hard part is, as a journalist, the best journalist allows their humanity to come through, right? Allows empathy, allows vulnerability. And yet in a world where you're constantly under attack, that is the challenge for us now. I think that what we've seen globally is that now journalists are aware. Female journalists are under attack more. It's almost like we've had the same type of sexist, misogynistic, illiberal leaders who attack us and give everyone in our societies free rein, permission to be their worst selves. And that's actually what it is. So the journalist bears the brunt of all of that. What we've seen is if you talk about it, if you do provide counseling, it's not so new anymore. And social media, frankly, that's the other thing. We should be holding social media, big tech, accountable for these things. And we're seeing cases being filed in different parts of the world now. This is not where it will end. And I guess part of what I try to do is I try to not just help our journalists cope with today. Rappler has about 100 people and our median age is young. Our youth, 23 years old is our median age and we're 63% women, right? It's not all bleak. We try to get through this together and then we look at what is exciting. The exciting part of today is that if we can conquer our own fears, then we can help create something far better than what we are living through now. That is part of what pushes me to keep doing our jobs, to tell you how horrible it is. It is horrible. We are living through a horrific time, but we can make it better by what we do today.
Então, eu queria que você falasse um pouquinho sobre a sua carreira, que também está muito presente no livro e que explica um pouco dessa maneira como você lida com isso, como a Kátia perguntou. Você era uma jornalista já internacionalmente conhecida, correspondente internacional da CNN, foi também executiva da empresa. Você é filipino-americana, então você poderia escolher se estabelecer nos Estados Unidos, sua família estava lá, mas você optou por ficar nas Filipinas e depois fez uma segunda escolha não usual, que foi abrir o seu próprio veículo. Como essas escolhas te definem e como você vê a correção delas olhando para trás e mesmo para tudo que você passou?
It's so much more certainty in the past. You know, I worked for CNN when it was chicken noodle news. And in many ways, I wrote this in the book, I understood what Facebook, what these tech companies were going through, because we went from being chicken noodle news to the world's news leader in terms of breaking news, right? And I watched us make policies, make mistakes that build better policies. But I think what we have seen is that the platforms haven't taken this as seriously as journalists do. In fact, they deny, the 3Ds, deny, deflect, right? Distort. So as a journalist, I went from being trained as a broadcast journalist, where I chose television because in this screen, there are a lot more subtle things that you may not read on a page. You know, what's behind me, the mood, the smile, there are all these things that I loved about television, the sound. And yet, unlike social media, there still are boundaries. You can't make things up, which now social media and AI will allow us to do that, right? So we still had a shared reality. I think today, part of the reason I shifted, I went to become a manager from being a reporter, is I spent most of my 20s and 30s learning breaking news. And at a certain point, you look for meaning and what the purpose of news is, of journalism is, the mission of journalism. I've helped write standards and ethics manuals for four or five different news organizations. And I never wanted to be a news head. It's just, I didn't want to be managed by a bad manager. News organizations in the hands of a business person can be corrupted very easily, right? Because your vested interest, you're seeing this play out in tech, right? When they can't tell the difference from their own vested interest and the public sphere, we must always put that in place. And I guess now with Rappler, I loved, when I was with CNN at the tail end, our team was one of 12 groups, 12 bureaus, where we tested new technology. I always knew technology was going to be both our enemy and our partner. Fair. Right now, we're going through a downturn where technology has made our world the worst we can be. I think it encourages the worst of human nature. And I hope that we come out of it and build something better than where we are today.
Perfeito. Patrícia.
Maria, você é bastante crítica do que você diz que são os jornalistas que se transformam em influenciadores. Você diz que esses influenciadores têm a estrutura de incentivos errada, que eles são ruins para o ecossistema de informações. O que é um jornalista influenciador e por que eles são ruins?
Well, please don't ever call a journalist an influencer. You know, this is a problem. What are influencers? And sorry for people who want to be an influencer. If you want to be an influencer, please don't make that your goal. Make expertise your goal. I mean, think about the incentive structure of social media. Let's start with the teenagers who are on Instagram. What is their goal? They curate their lives so that they are performing for the popularity of a crowd. But what they forget and what they're constantly living with is that crowd turns into a mob like this. And when it turns into a mob and you're a teenager, this shifts your values and your lives. So you're living far more shallow lives. So a journalist is driven by mission. We're not driven by popularity. If you were driven by popularity, then please don't be a journalist. It's tough. Patricia, you know this. Standing up to power requires conviction. requires courage. I see this in our journalists. Look, I get emotional on this. I think that this popularity game that should have ended in high school, that has now encroached into every part of our reality, must stop, because it brought about the death of expertise. It brought about, you know, there was a 2007 book written by Andrew Keen called The Cult of the Amateur. We don't want to be popular, to play to the crowd, to give the crowd what it wants, but in the process, you lose yourself. That, you know, having said that, there are influencers in makeup, in different things, right? The knowledge of, okay, fine, but the clustering algorithms that grow these have all changed. Please be an expert at something. Don't aim to just be an influencer. If you have expertise and you're an influencer, great, but don't rely on it, because these algorithms change like this. And if you're a journalist who wants to be an influencer, please don't be a journalist.
Muito bom. Cecília, por favor.
Maria, você mencionou aí, né, que uma das ações que podem ser feitas para poder mudar um pouco essa realidade é que os Estados Unidos, por exemplo, tomassem posição diante das empresas que estão sediadas no país. Os Estados Unidos gostam de se colocar no cenário mundial como o país que tem a missão de levar a democracia para muitos países. Mas a gente enfrentou isso aqui com o golpe de 64, com a influência deles na hoje já desacreditada Operação Lava Jato. E no seu país, os Estados Unidos também apoiaram ditaduras, né? Então, assim, os Estados Unidos são um parceiro confiável, ou países como os nossos deveriam buscar fortalecer relações sul-sul para fortalecer suas democracias?
I think we've moved to a world that is multilateral, but the United Nations hasn't stepped up to the challenge, right? And again, it goes back, because if you look at the National Security Council today, it's actually not made up of democracies. The world is tilting towards authoritarian dictatorships, towards fascism. So when you talk about, the reason I go to the United States is because these were primarily American companies. I go back to the beginning of the cascading failures, right? Which is, do not make lies spread faster than facts. That's the fundamental problem. If you fix that problem, a lot of these cascading failures, the kinds of information operations used by illiberal countries, Russia, Iran, these things can be stopped, right? But right now, at a fundamental cellular level, intelligence groups used to do this at societal scale, but never at the cellular level of democracy, which is at the personal level. This is what needs to stop. So that's the first step. And now these American companies are being pushed by a Chinese company, TikTok, ByteDance. And if you look at what TikTok has been able to do, it has two different codes, right? That it has pushed out to the world. The one that is far better for its domestic audience. It sets a cap at how long any person 14 years old, its children, how long its children can stay on TikTok. It has educational videos. That Tristan Harris from Silicon Valley called it the spinach version of TikTok. It kept it for China. And then it exported the opioid version, the one that is addictive, the one that doesn't give you a choice. If you think of Facebook as a blunt mallet, TikTok is a surgical probe into our minds. So, long answer to your question, because in the end, this is what we must stop, the ability to manipulate, because at scale, it creates emergent human behavior that leans to fascism.
Certo. Com isso, então, a gente fecha o nosso terceiro bloco, vai para mais um breve intervalo, volta já já com mais Roda Viva com a Nobel da Paz, Maria Ressa. We'll be right back. Estamos de volta com o Roda Viva, que hoje recebe a jornalista e escritora filipina Maria Ressa. Quem pergunta para ela agora é a Adriana Ferreira Silva.
Maria, numa época em que fake news, né, notícias falsas, se transformam em verdades absolutas, que se espalham, impossíveis de controlar, e o contrário, as notícias verdadeiras têm uma restrição ali, quais foram as estratégias que você desenvolveu com o Rappler para conseguir mudar as narrativas?
We came up with a whole of society approach. It has been our most successful attempt so far, and we haven't stopped. I actually look forward to learning also from Brazil. You know, we came up with a four-layer pyramid where a data pipeline connects all four layers. The bottom layer is 16 news organizations working together on fact checks. This has never happened in the Philippines. That data goes up to the second layer. So we know fact checks don't spread, you know. So what is the second layer? It's called the mesh. The mesh are civil society groups, NGOs, human rights activists, business groups, the church. These are 116 different organizations whose goal is to spread these fact checks and add emotion. They're not allowed to use anger or hate. And what we found was that inspiration spreads as fast as anger or hate. That was huge. We were able to actually take over, retake the center of the Facebook information ecosystem in our country. The third layer are our academics. Six different new academic institutions doing research on disinformation, where every week one of them took turns and took the data we had and told our people how we were being manipulated, who was being attacked, what meta-narratives were used. And the last one, layer four, is critical because this is legal groups, right? Six different legal groups finally coming together. And they, the lawyers, were far more energized than the exhausted journalists at the bottom of the pyramid. Because those lawyers, in 3 months, filed more than 20 legal cases to protect the journalists and the mesh layer so that we could speak truth to power. It's an attempt. It's still, you know, lies still spread faster than facts. But when you bring a whole of society approach to the real world and then use social media collectively together, there's a chance.
Eu queria que ainda seguir nessa toada da Adriana, antes de passar para o Jefferson, porque tem um bordão que você usa muito no seu livro, que é defenda a linda, a linha, hold the line. E como que você e o Rappler defenderam a linha e como que nós, jornalistas do mundo inteiro, temos que defender a linha? O que é que significa esse bordão?
It means that regardless of how you are attacked, you know, whether it is the exponential horrific attacks on social media or whether they're legal cases, that you do not voluntarily give up your rights. And it is the same for a journalist as it is for a citizen. You know, the statistics show us that the public sphere is controlled by the outermost, the 6 or 7% that are on the outskirts. Everyone else stays silent, right? Silence is consent. The second part of that is that you hold the line comes from literally knowing the rights of our constitution. And even when the Duterte administration was pushing us back, trying to push us back with a bulldozer, trying to use our fears against us, we held the line. We linked arms with our community. We couldn't have survived without them. With journalists all around the world who helped us shine the light. And we did not voluntarily give up our rights. I'm hoping that the rest of the legal cases, part of the political harassment, will go the way of the last four tax evasion charges. But, you know, I've submitted myself to the courts. That's a very different thing. We're not quite North Korea or Russia. I hope I still have belief in the integrity of the men and women in the judiciary, right? This is it. I said this in the Nobel lecture. This is an individual battle for integrity. We must fight our battles and win them.
Maravilhoso, Jefferson.
Maria, você citou na sua resposta anterior, né, o quanto que vocês no Rappler se inspiraram em iniciativas, por exemplo, do Brasil e criaram esse mecanismo todo de integração com a sociedade civil, com advogados e tal. E aí eu queria te perguntar que outros, né, quais são esses exemplos que vocês viram, não só no Brasil, mas em outros países, de meios de comunicação que, como vocês, né, se comprometem com as pessoas que têm menos... Que são menos assistidas, né, que têm menos espaço de serem escutadas, e aproveitar-se para falar sobre uma iniciativa que você faz parte, que é o Fundo Internacional para Mídia de Interesse Público, né, o IFPIN. Como que esse trabalho, que é uma parte menos conhecida do que você faz, como é que você tem visto, né, essas iniciativas que têm a ver com jornalismo, com democracia, com tudo, com muito disso que a gente está conversando aqui?
We need more. We need to bring them into the real world. Look, I think part of what I found fascinating with Brazil is that the health issues, Zika, was, you know, the way the anti-vax moved through society, that in the end, this isn't just about politics. It isn't, because when you don't have facts, it impacts every part of our existence. You know, I say this all the time now, since 2016, if you don't have facts, you can't have truth. Without truth, you can't have trust. Without these, we have no shared reality. We cannot have democracy. Democracy is just a tail end. The shared reality, which journalists aren't the only ones in charge of this. We need the help of our societies. And when I say, you know, hold the line, for journalists, we're in the front line, but behind us are every society. It's like that quote, you know, they came for, there's this quote in the Philippines, and I think it was also used in Brazil. First, they came for the journalists. We don't know what happened next. So this was a Martin Niemöller quote that was used in Nazi Germany as well, right? For the Jews, if you don't speak, you will be left alone. No one else will speak for you. So, no, I think I'm still studying what you guys did in the last elections. How I wish January 8th didn't happen, but Patricia and I had talked about this months ago. When you pump toxic sludge through people, when you incite hate, it pops out in the real world. And our problem globally is how to control that violence.
Kátia.
Maria, várias vezes você citou o TikTok. Agora, recentemente, o New York Times aderiu ao TikTok. New York Times, responsável por algumas das melhores reportagens, algumas das melhores produções jornalísticas do mundo. Você trabalhou na chamada mídia convencional, na imprensa consolidada, e depois migrou para o que a gente chama dos nativos digitais, né, da imprensa independente, criando o que você chama de uma startup, inclusive para ser ágil nas mudanças, né? Você acredita que o caminho para a gente sair dessa situação passa mais por essa mídia convencional, mesmo ela estando aderindo a essas questões de rede social, passa mais por esse processo da mídia independente? De onde vem o financiamento para o jornalismo que a gente precisa fazer daqui para frente?
The old days are gone. You know, we can't go back to the past because the distribution of information is owned by tech. And they have no conscience. Sorry, they truly don't, right? Because the goal is surveillance capitalism, and it is technology that gives them godlike powers, but they do not have godlike wisdom. So look, we had this debate inside Rappler where I did not want to go on TikTok. I'm not on TikTok at all. And yet Rappler knew that it was important to reach people where they are. So before the New York Times went on, before our elections, we went on TikTok. And, you know, again, this is a surgical probe to your mind. You have no choices anymore, right? And what they find is that it is even more addictive for the users of TikTok, because there's absolutely no choice. It just keeps feeding you. We must create. I think the first step is you have to hold those who are using this, those who created this technology to account. They cannot have a license to print money, which is what they've been given, right? Because the lawmakers themselves don't understand the technology. Then after you put those guardrails in place, then we can rebuild civil society. But if we were to all pull out of social media today, then you leave others far more vulnerable, right? This is a chicken or the egg question, which is which? And Katya, I mean, it's a fantastic question. I lost the debate in Rappler. Rappler is on TikTok. And I still look at the numbers to try to figure out whether that's worth it. But should we be telling our kids, our audience on TikTok? Do they care? I think the hard part is this. Without trust, we have nothing. We know this. George Shultz, who lived 100 years old, in his last writing actually said that the greatest lesson he learned as a statesman is that with trust in the room, anything is possible. Without trust, nothing is possible. I go back to the tech companies. They are destroying trust globally, and that must stop.
Então, a gente encerra o nosso penúltimo bloco com a Maria Ressa, vai para o nosso último intervalo e volta já já para o encerramento desse Roda Viva histórico. Esse é daqueles programas que a gente não quer que acabe, mas estamos no nosso último bloco. Quem vai perguntar agora é a Patrícia Campos Mello.
Maria, você foi atacada de todos os jeitos, online, offline, xingada de todos os nomes, processada. Quanto de tudo isso está relacionado ao fato de você ser mulher?
I think inescapably at the core. The kinds of attacks, you would know this also, Patricia, the kinds of attacks attack my sex, my gender, my sexuality. And it encourages both sexism and misogyny. It was part of it. It is happening not just to me. Look, I talk about this all the time, you know, it's the worst of human nature is what these social media platforms encourage. And I talk about the devil and the angel. There's this old cartoon where you have to make a principled decision and, you know, the devil is here telling you, do it, do it, do it, do it, do it. And then the angel is saying, no, don't do it because that's bad. You will hurt other people. What social media did is it gagged the angel. And then it flicked it off your shoulder, and then it made the devil 12 foot tall and gave it a direct pipeline into your emotions. That is what it did for everyone around the world. So sexism, misogyny, off the scale globally. And that's directly linked to the rise of the far right.
Cecília?
O ex-presidente Duterte prometeu uma guerra às drogas. Muita gente foi morta, executada ali, sem nenhum direito à defesa, sem nenhuma culpa comprovada, sem nada disso, sem nenhum julgamento. E aqui no Brasil a gente tem muitos políticos, muitas autoridades que defendem esse tipo de ação. Guerra às drogas é de fato sobre drogas?
It's about power and control. It's about fear. Part of the reason the last administration was effective was people were afraid. And when you put silence as complicity, right, the kind of the overwhelming message Filipinos got is it is okay to kill. This is what was going out on social media. But it isn't okay to kill. Even our church, you know, the Philippines is Asia's largest Roman Catholic nation. And even the church for a period of time was far more muted than it should have been. So no, I think this is one of the things that, again, must change.
Maria, você, eu falei aqui no começo do programa, você fez teatro, você tocou em orquestras, você é fã de Star Trek, Você até aprendeu a andar de skate. Como esse seu lado, né? O que você diz no final lá do livro, vou dar aqui um spoiler, de que a sua vida no fim vai ser sempre sobre os seus amores e sobre quem você é. Como isso te ajudou a segurar a sua própria onda, a aguentar tudo isso?
I think the question everyone always asked me, in 2019, I received 10 arrest warrants in less than 2 years. And people always ask, so how do you find courage? This is why I wrote the book. How to stand up against a dictator is not just about Duterte, it's about Mark Zuckerberg. Who's the bigger dictator, right? Who has the whole world to play in? But I think how you stand up to these bullies goes all the way back to what we knew when we were in kindergarten, when we were in grade school. There have always been bullies. We need to stand up because all it takes is one and you can shift the world you live in. So it goes back to values. It goes back to, I believe in God. I believe in the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I also believe that democracy is the most equal merit. It's a meritocratic society where checks and balances guard against the worst of human nature. We've lived through several cycles of history, and I guess that's what excites me about what we must do. It's horrific. It can be horrific at times, but collectively, I don't forget the goodness of human nature, that in general, if you don't have someone inciting to hate, you know, we're very imperfect beings, but it is both. It begins inside you. The question I ask in the book is, what are you willing to sacrifice for the truth? So it begins inside you and it seeps into our news organizations, into our government, into the society we want to create. And God, we still need to fix the world. Climate change is about to make it existential.
Sim, Jefferson.
Maria, você se tornou, nos últimos anos, uma jornalista muito conhecida, né? Uma repórter muito conhecida, ainda que você acompanhe uma redação de mais de 100 pessoas. Mas como que esse fato, não só no seu país, mas no mundo todo, influencia no seu trabalho, na maneira como as fontes, como as pessoas com quem você vai produzir suas matérias ou entrevistar, como que isso influencia na maneira como elas te tratam, como elas te veem?
Oh my gosh, Jefferson, thank you. Thank you for the question. But you know, I left my editorial position in Rappler in 2020 because I can't interview our Secretary of Justice and not actually call him out, right? This is what we're supposed to do as journalists. So I found that because I was so targeted that I really couldn't do my job as a journalist. This is something that women under attack have been forced to deal with, journalists under attack. I see it makes our jobs harder and it pushes us, you asked a question about activism, it pushes us towards activism. But in the end, I am fundamentally a journalist. I ask questions. I think it's also let me see the other parts of our humanity that I didn't focus on as much as before. And I guess part of the reason why this becomes important now is because this is a time of creation. We need to create a new journalism, new ways of telling stories that will capture our public away, take them away from the abyss of hate and bring them back, remind them about our common reality.
Adriana?
Um pouco nessa vibe, nessa onda do que o Jefferson perguntou, tem muitos historiadores que dizem que o século XXI só começou agora, depois da pandemia de Covid-19. E, para nós, jornalistas, foi um desafio enorme, não só porque, ao mesmo tempo em que era muito essencial o nosso trabalho, era muito difícil o nosso trabalho. Você, além de jornalista, é uma pesquisadora do jornalismo. Como deve ser para você o jornalismo do século XXI?
Oh, gosh, we are living our way into this. now, right? And I think this is part of what we're trying to do in Rappler. What is the form? The substance of journalism needs to be there. The standards and ethics manual that guide our consciences, that allow us to be effective gatekeepers, that allow us to hold power to account. But individually now, when chaos reigns, when facts don't get wide distribution, when lies, when the worst of human nature is what is encouraged in these tech platforms, what do? We stick to our values. That's why you go back to that. And it almost feels like, you know, the dam is about to burst on us, and we're, the journalists are just sitting there putting our finger in the dam to prevent it from crushing us. That's the danger we all live in now, right? And I hope that we can innovate fast enough that we can create what journalism will be, but we cannot do this if technology, if big tech doesn't actually realize the fundamental core of a functioning democracy.
Kátia?
Maria. A Patrícia, que está aqui com a gente no estúdio, eu assisti uma palestra dela em que ela contou que ela cobriu vários conflitos no mundo, e, né, vários lugares conflituosos, e que ela sentiu mais medo no Brasil do que cobrindo conflitos. Você também teve a experiência de viajar o mundo como jornalista, de trabalhar em lugares perigosos, e também disse que se sentia com medo de andar nas ruas do seu próprio país. Como é essa sensação de insegurança, de não poder andar livremente como uma cidadã nas ruas do seu próprio país?
I've never felt that I couldn't walk freely. I still do, but, you know, like with our people, we've increased security. Look, I covered every conflict in Southeast Asia, nearly every conflict in Asia and South Asia. Inevitably, there's this time period where you take the attacks with you, where it's in your pocket, you wake up with it, it changes the way you think, the way you view the world. That's the danger. And it is a war zone. I've covered so many of these conflicts where the bullets are coming from this end, and you know that you're going to get behind the people who are shooting. It's far easier, strangely, to cover a war zone than the world we now live in, where it is impossible to tell fact from fiction. This is as a journalist, right? So how do I take it? I don't take it into the real world, except as the head of Rappler, I make sure our people are protected. There have been times in the book I lay this out where I've had to have security, I've had to wear protective bulletproof vests in this, you know, while you're just driving down the traffic filled streets of Manila. But I guess part of what I try not to do is I try not to make it get in the way of communicating with people, because that's our goal, right? Like, and in the end, vulnerability, being vulnerable to the person you are interviewing is critical. You have to give to get, and that's what I do not want to lose.
Maravilhoso. Maria, muito obrigada por essa entrevista tão elucidativa para a gente.
I look to you. Thank you for having me.
Muito obrigada. É isso, nosso programa chegou ao fim. Além de agradecer imensamente a Maria Ressa por essa entrevista que vem sendo tentada há meses, pela sua relevância, que finalmente foi possível, eu agradeço também a essa bancada maravilhosa que dividiu os trabalhos comigo. Patrícia Campos Melo, Cecília Oliveira, Adriana Ferreira Silva, Kátia Brembate e Jefferson Barbosa, e também a nossa tradutora, a Áurea Delbois. Agradeço sobretudo a você pela sua audiência para programas que trazem temas que nem sempre são muito fáceis, mas que são da maior importância. No seu livro, a Maria Ressa repete muitas vezes um bordão que eu tratei aqui e que a ajudou a suportar com resiliência, até com bom humor, uma pressão que muita gente não aguentaria. Ela diz que é preciso defender a linha. No jornalismo, defender a linha significa estabelecer princípios éticos inegociáveis e resistir aos poderosos, sejam eles governantes ou corporações, que tentam cruzá-los para sufocar as liberdades. uma lição que vem lá das Filipinas, mas que vale para o Brasil e para qualquer lugar do mundo que preze a democracia. O Roda Viva volta na próxima segunda-feira, quando receberemos ao vivo a ministra da Saúde, Anísia Trindade, a primeira mulher a ocupar o posto desde a redemocratização. De novo, vai ser um programa imperdível e eu espero você. Até lá!